Our website is www.LakeHamiltonBibleCamp.com and LHBCOnline.com. There are many free audio files there. It's like going to Bible school at home. This is the 2010 Labor Day Teaching and Deliverance Camp Meeting being held at Lake Hamilton Bible Camp in Hot Springs National Park, Arkansas. This is Thursday evening, September the 2nd, 2010. Colonel Speed Wilson is the speaker of the evening, teaching on World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam. Also, this message had some occasional mic popping, which was beyond our control. This is now the conclusion of this message from Part A.
Now, this was a real airplane. This is the Bearcat. Same engine as the Corsair, 2,500 horsepower maximum, but it weighed a third less. This thing would go straight up. I put on flight demonstration at county and state fairs where I put it on the end of the runway and put a 2x4 300 feet in front of it and never touched the 2x4. You couldn't give it a full engine run-up without tying the tail to a tie-down because the brakes would hold, but the airplane just started jumping. And it's the only airplane you start the engine with the canopy closed because the engine's so close and you got a wet start and the flame come back and singe your eyebrows. So you started with the engine. I was told and asked to go over to Pittsburgh when they were dedicating the greater Pittsburgh airport. They wanted some air show over there. And I demonstrated the airplane the day before. But the next day, an Air Force pilot showed up in a P-51. And, of course, he knew he was the hottest around. So he challenged me. And, of course, they played it up, the MC, that they just had a challenge from the Air Force. I hadn't heard anything about it. It's challenged the Marine Corps to do a combat battle over the field so everybody can see a real aerial battle. And so he came over to me, would you do it? Sure, I'll do it. So we lined up side by side on the runway right at the end of it. And, of course, by the time he got his wheels up, I was at 2,000 feet waiting for him. He didn't know what the Bearcat would do, so he didn't have a prayer. I made three passes on him, and everybody realized he was a dead duck. And so we knew that the Corsair was winning all the closed-circuit races, but everybody that ever flew this thing knew that it would win all the races. So it did. It beat the Corsair out. And the Bearcat won all the closed circuit, the Thompson trophies, until 2006. The P-51 Mustang finally won a race. And there was only 3 seconds difference between the Bearcat and the Dago Red was the name of the P-51. And their average speed, now get this, going around and around a 12-mile circle, it's a circle 12 miles in diameter, going around and around, the average speed was 508 miles an hour in a prop-driven airplane. Now, of course, they modified it for your airplane people. It didn't have the 2,500 horsepower. It had 3,500 horsepower. It had 3 banks of cylinders instead of 2. So, okay, the next one. And then, after finishing up at Akron and getting that squadron off, and going, got them all qualified, except a professor from Kent State, a psychologist. He had problems. So, you know, as I said, anybody to go see a psychiatrist ought to have his head examined. So, went down to Kingsville, Texas. And we had the T-28B, good airplane, tricycle landing gear, 2-seater. And this was the final phase at Kingsville before the Navy and Marine Corps cadets would get their wings and join the fleet. And the T-28 cruised at about 250 miles an hour, excellent airplane, get them used to flying a tricycle landing gear and lock them in the back seat under the canopy, learn to fly instruments. The next one. Now, the interesting thing was when I checked in at Kingsville, which was the largest air base in the United States based on the number of airplanes and the number of hours flown, when I checked in, the Navy commander, Navy captain, Captain Rice, excellent officer, he says, Major Wilson, we've been accused of discrimination here. We've never had a Marine in charge of the jet training here, so you're going to be the first one. So I took over. So we had 300 Navy officer instructors, and 100 Marine Corps officer instructors and 1,200 students, four students to each pilot. And we were flying this, the T-28 and this, and the T-33. Some of you know it. I don't have a good picture of it, which we call the Lockheed Aluminum Canoe. It was the most horrible jet plane you ever flew. But this was a good one. The F-9F Tiger Cat. And we called it the Grumman Ironworks because you couldn't hurt it. And it was excellent for that kind of job. So this was what the students flew in. Now, there was being in charge. Of course, the Navy pilots didn't like it too well with the Marine in charge of the whole operation. And, I don't need to get all of that. But anyway, my hard hat, my helmet, I had two big Marine insignias on the front and a big one on the back so they could figure out that I was running the show. I had 17 civilians running all the paperwork, and Mrs. Johnson is the head of it. And she said one day, says, "You Marines all dress the same." I said, "Well, thank you, Mrs. Johnson." Of course, the Navy, they wear their, I've been to the Philippine belt buckles and their purple boots, and it's just awful the way the Navy officers dress, but that's their problem. So we went from here, and one thing is very interesting. I was able to get rid of the commander that was in charge of jet maintenance. He was a Marine, he was a Navy line officer, maintenance officer, and he just wasn't doing the job. And so I got my friend, Major Dell Davis. We had known each other from World War II, and he took over maintenance, and everything really improved. And so Dell was also carrying a load of students, four students. And so we realized that, having been in combat, that these kids had never gone through this tail chase type thing of trying to get on the tail. Even with the heat seeker missiles, you still have to get on the tail, because that's where the heat's coming from, out of the tail of the end of the plane, before you can fire your missile and be sure of getting him. So they had never gone through dogfighting and all of that. So we went to Captain Rice and said, "We'd like to have 6 hours of additional flight time to teach these fighter pilots what being a fighter pilot is. They can fly the airplane now, but they've never really been challenged." And so he wasn't a fighter pilot. He said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, it's very simple. If you get on the tail of an enemy airplane, you forget about which is up and down or all that. You just lock on, and as long as he's flying, you can probably fly. Just stay back there. If the idiot crashes, don't follow him. But as long as he's airborne, you can probably be airborne." So we'd take him out and put him in. He said, "I can't authorize that." So we went over to Corpus Christi, the admiral in charge of all advanced training all over the United States. And he said, "Well, I can't give you 6 hours. I'll give you four. Let's see how it works out." So that's what we did. And boy, 10 years later, I was at headquarters, Marine Corps, and I was walking along, leaving, getting ready to go home. And a young captain came running up to me and saluted and said, "Colonel Wilson, do you remember me?" I said, "Well, I remember the face." He said, "Well, I was one of your students at Kingsville." And I said, "Well," it's funny, one night at the bar, one of my students was behind me, and he didn't know that I was in front of him. And he was telling one of the others, says, "My instructor's so damned old, he flew one of the first Corsairs." I looked around, and he ducked his head and walked out. But this one says, "Well, do you remember that time that you got the hassle time and we got that?" And says, "When we got to the fleet, boy, we were doing things in the jets that nobody had ever seen done, because we, you know." He said, "Did you know that you and Major Davis started Top Gun?" I said, "No, I never did." He said, "Well, when they saw what we were doing, then they started doing it. And if you want to see a real authentic movie, go see the movie Top Gun. That's where they started doing what we were doing, teaching all the Navy and Marine Corps pilots how to win." And okay, so next one. And this one we'll come to in just a minute. But from Kingsville, I went over to Japan, and as a major, and through a chain of events, I became the commanding officer of Marine Corps Air Station Iwakuni. I started out as the supply officer, then the intelligence officer, and then the executive officer, and then the commanding officer was an alcoholic, and he started taking tranquilizers with his martinis, and And so he ended up, and so I became commanding officer. So here I was a major in a colonel's billet. And they never saw fit to relieve me. And had command of about 2,000 Marines and 7,000 Japanese civil service to keep the base running. Because we had 15,000 Marines there, the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing. And we had about 5,000 Navy of the 7th Fleet headquarters. And they had the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force there. So I had about 35,000 to 40,000 people that I had to provide facilities for. So that was the whole thing. And it went off rather well. And I got a special letter of commendation for it and knew that I'd probably make Lieutenant Colonel. And I did. I made Lieutenant Colonel a year ahead of my contemporaries. But then I came back and went to Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, except about 20 miles north of Philadelphia, and was flying this airplane. What an airplane. Now, if you're an airplane enthusiast, you'll look at it and think it's an F-86. No, it isn't. It's made by North American, but there's no comparison. This is the FJ-4 Fury. It has the same wing as the 104. This wing is not skin and ribs. It's cast magnesium and aluminum. And it's machined. They machine the top half and the bottom half, and the wing is full of fuel on both sides. And it had a Rolls-Royce jet engine in it. Boy, it would go. Beautiful airplane. And it wouldn't go supersonic straight and level, but it would push 9.8. Just under, you could drop the nose slightly and it'd shudder a little bit, and then it'd go through supersonic. And beautiful airplane. Some of the pilots that ever flew it, like Marion Carl and Bob Hoover and the others, when they were asked, well, if you could have any airplane you wanted, most of them chose this one. Because it was the kind of airplane that a pilot would really love. It was great. Well, and also, I had 100 reserve pilots flying these, 25 of them in every weekend, before weekend. Really great. All of them were veterans. Some of them were World War II veterans. All of them were Korean veterans, and they knew what they were doing. And so I loved to fly, and they realized it. We also had 4 helicopter squadrons. I had a captain in charge of the helicopters. We had a radar intercept. And that was really great duty. I think that was the best duty I ever had, because the airplane and the people. And so we left there and went from there to Chicago, because we won all the safety awards and long-time war, all the records of all the air reserve units at 17 air bases. We were number one for 2 consecutive years. And so they transferred me to Chicago and put me in charge of a computer center where I was taking care of about 150,000 reserve records. These were reserves that weren't participating in weekend warrior operations, but they still had 3 to 5 years that they could be recalled to active duty. And it was my job to see that they were kept up to current so we could reach them and all that sort of thing, and that they were discharged at the same time. And if we have time during this time here, Lee Harvey Oswald was one of the people I had his record. So I got involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, and I'm here to tell you that Oswald did not kill the president. And some others did not, too. But anyhow, I had to go give my testimony before the Supreme Court investigation. And when I got there, I could realize that they were just making it up as they went. But anyway, so out there, and I instituted quite a few changes in the records and all that sort of thing, and a little imagination. And the Headquarters Marine Corps, after I'd been there nearly 3 years, not quite 3 years, you usually change duty stations about every 3 years, so if you don't like it, you wait it out for 3 years and go somewhere else. And if you don't like your boss, you'll change in about 3 years. So they sent a message to headquarters at Glenview up north of Chicago to send a lieutenant colonel from the staff there to do duty at Headquarters Marine Corps in the Division of Reserve. So the operations officer nominated his assistant, who was a meathead, and the message came back. It said, "Send Speed Wilson." So I went to Washington and got there, and I was in charge of reserve personnel for the whole Marine Corps. Had about 200,000 Marines active duty weekend warriors at 283 reserve training centers and 17 air bases. In fact, we had as many Marines participating in the reserves as there were on active duty. And I went there as the director of personnel, and then went up to deputy director, and was there for a year, and then became a deputy director. I was second in command. And in that position, I have to give you a little background, that was a troublous time, because Vietnam was going pretty bad at that time. And I had figured out by that time that the government was not our friend, and we weren't going to be allowed to win in Vietnam, and we may get into that shortly. But anyway, I became deputy director. And the Marines now, the reserve Marines, at the 283 reserve training centers throughout the whole United States, they are not like National Guard. They are federal troops. And in that capacity, we could sit in on all the CIA briefings and all the defense intelligence briefings, and we got briefings from the FBI that nobody got. So we knew what was going on. And probably when we talk about understanding world events, we'll get on to that. But it was really very exciting. And of course, in that capacity, I sat on the contingency planning. And we had to meet once a month, or whenever there was an emergency. So we knew in that capacity, if there was anything that needed to be tasked to the Commandant of the Marine Corps, I would brief him on it and get together with all of them. But anyway, it was really interesting, because I was the junior on the contingency planning. There were four three-star generals and a two-star admiral and the others, and here I was representing the Marine Corps as a bird colonel. But that's pretty typical. But we're a minority. They always picked on us. So in that capacity, I also had to go once every 3 months over to give a report of how the reserve was coming on to the Senate Armed Forces Committee. Senator Stennis, a dear old Christian brother from Mississippi, and his senior minority was Barry Goldwater. I got to know him real well. He called me by my first name, Speed, and I called him by his first name, Senator. And but Ruth and I were invited to Nixon's inaugural ball, and we went, and here was Senator Goldwater standing over in the corner. And I went over to him, and I said, "Senator," and I was almost in tears. "I'm so sorry you weren't elected president." And he says, "Oh, forget it, Speed." He says, "After I've read the newspaper, listened to radio, and watched the television, I damn near voted for Johnson, too." But Ruth spotted Ronald Reagan over in the corner, so we went over, and she got his autograph on our invitation. So we still have that, and a few other movie stars who were there. And it was really great. But Goldwater wrote a book entitled Without Apology, outlining the New World Order at that time, 1964. So, and Washington, D.C., well, let's flip the next one. And my daughter put this together. It was 212th Squadron, Corsairs, F7F. Flip it, next one, three war veteran. These are critical elements that we do not have in the United States. So, in contingency planning, aluminum, so many things that are short supply. Okay, the next one. And now the problem of Vietnam. People say, "Well, why did we go to Vietnam? What was the interest there?" And they sit and argue about it and all that sort of thing. Well, we had a treaty. It was called Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. It included most of the countries, Korea, of course, and the Philippines, and Taiwan, Taipei, Australia, New Zealand, all those. Mutual defense treaties. If one of them was attacked, we'd come to it. The same as NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty. By the way, only two senators voted against the ratification here. Oh, Gruning of Alaska and one old character from Oregon, Wayne Morris of Oregon, voted against it. Eight senators voted against NATO because they realized this is more important. Besides, Europe is always fighting. So that's why we were there. And the thing about the Tonkin Bay was just a bunch of smoke and mirrors. Okay, next one. By the way, we had 43 mutual defense treaties, and we had to steady key up to date. Now, here's what we're talking about. Here's China, of course, Russia, and here's Vietnam down here. Next one. And, of course, here was North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and the next one. This is China over here. Now, when we went there in contingency planning, because we knew that the communists were invading, and it was to establish to stop communist aggression. That was the first thing to do. The second was to free the South Vietnam to choose its own destiny, a free country, and to remove all foreign military troops from South Vietnam, including the United States, and an effective guarantee of freedom for the people of South Vietnam. Now, we felt that that would take, I thought it would take about 7 years, and that was pretty popular, but because the budget cycle is on a 5-year cycle, we assigned 5 years to it. Next one. And here's where the Marines landed on in 1965. And they landed. I always like Art Buchwald, the old humorist columnist. They taunted him, and he was pushing for Goldwater. And they said, well, you vote for Goldwater, and 3 months, well, Marines will be landing in Vietnam. So he voted for Goldwater, and sure enough, 3 months later, we were landing in Vietnam. But you remember, Lyndon Baines Johnson won. Goldwater didn't. So the biggest traitor of the whole thing was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. His full name was Robert Strange McNamara. And he was pretty strange. He and his two idiots, Enthoven and Volz, both with doctor's degrees. The old senator from Chicago, oh, heck, dear old fella. He said that F. Dirksen asked him what he thought about the Secretary of Defense. He said, well, he's educated far beyond his intelligence, his living and delusions of grandeur. And another time he was pretty angry. He said, they call them educated idiots. And they were. Our commandant had Enthoven and Volz come over to headquarters and give us a briefing just to see how stupid they really were. But they weren't stupid. They were doing what they were supposed to do. They were seeing to it that we didn't win in Vietnam. Now, here was the plan for Vietnam. Next one. Vietnam, if up here, it's not a small place. If you put this at Boston up at the northern tip, the southern tip would be at Jacksonville, Florida. So it's the whole east coast of the United States. Next one. Now, in World War II, when the Japanese had it, this is Haiphong, Haiphong Harbor, where all the supplies came. But for them to get their supplies, they had to come through a 5-mile channel, through a sandbar, and only one ship at a time could get through it. When the Japanese had it, once every 10 days, they'd send a B-24 up there, loaded with little 250-pound fragmentation general-purpose bombs, and each bomb one would go off about every 3 or 4 hours for about 10 days so that they couldn't come and clean it out. So you cut off the supplies and get busy with the whole thing. You know, the Indians, you put them under siege and starve you out, and that's it, and they can't get any supplies. They couldn't get any supplies from China because we could cut the railroads up there. That was no problem. But dear old McNamara said, nope, we can't close Haiphong Harbor. And the Russians had over 100 ships busy supplying the war. Up and down, up and down. Okay, next one. Now, also, we were restricted to South Vietnam. Cambodia was off limits. So they just set up their supply lines over in Cambodia and resupply across here. We couldn't go over there and take them. If you want to see the sickening aspects of being a soldier in that, go see the movie, We Were Soldiers. If that won't make you eat nails and bite it, nobody would. It's sick. But after, and we got busy with the job of building and all that sort of thing. fight and all this sort of thing. But then the rules of engagement, because we, and by the way, Goldwater, our plan was to put in 250,000 troops immediately, occupy, because 97% of all the people in South Vietnam live within 30 miles of the coast. The rest of it's just jungle full of baboons, monkeys, lions, tigers, leopards, snakes, mosquitoes, all that stuff up in there, except down here, and that's very about the size of our Mississippi Delta, very rich. South Vietnam could live on 20% of its rice and ship out 80%. It was the only country in the whole area that raised more than they could use. And so it was very prime, very good. But Lyndon Johnson, oh, by the way, we were still winning, even with all of that, so they had to come out with rules of engagement. Now, at this time, I had gotten my orders, and I was Chief of Staff of the 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, is 20,000 Marines, two aircraft carriers, the Iwo Jima and Okinawa, with a squadron of helicopters on each one, four amphibious assault ships with 12 landing barges in each of those. We were making three and four landings a month, and we were really given a bad time. And we were also the standby reserve for the Marines that were land-based. If they needed any help, we were right there to do it. And it was really a challenging, but it was most challenging when I checked in to General Kearney. I had known him at headquarters, Marine Corps. And after we passed the time of May and asked a few things about what was happening back at headquarters, Marine Corps, and I briefed him about McNamara and the whole bunch. And finally I said, "General, are you okay?" He said, "No, Speed, I'm not okay. I had to be evacuated from Vietnam with malaria and maybe dysentery." He said, so Speed, you got it. You're it. You're running the outfit, and I'm going to finish up. I only have 6 months to do it. I'm going to finish it up. I'm not going home. And so if you have any problems that you can't handle, need any advice, I'll either be here or in my quarters or in the hospital. I'll be glad. So I took over. It was really challenging for an aviator. But we got, I say all that, and then we got the rules of engagement. And I separated out. It was a document of about 100 pages. Most of it applied to the Army and most of it to the Air Force, really. But I figured out what to brief the 9 bird colonels, 18 lieutenant colonels, 25 majors, and I don't know how many captains, all of them that had command positions, and the sergeant majors, of which there were 8, they all gathered, and I briefed them on the rules of engagement. And it boiled down that you could only return fire. You could only shoot after you've been shot at. Sergeant Major Ryan stood up and said, "Colonel Wilson, we all know this is your third..." I'd known him in Korea when he was a 3-striper. "We know this is your third war, and it's my second war, and it's been my experience, if you let the enemy shoot first, he hits you between the eyes, it blurs your vision." I said, "Sergeant Major, you just summarized rules of engagement." And when the guys come out from the States, they say, "How do you tell the good guys from the bad guys?" Because they don't wear uniforms. "Well, the bad guys shoot at you." Now, they're doing the same stupid thing over in the Middle East. You can only return fire. By the way, maybe we can get to the Middle East later. But finally, Lyndon Johnson, everything was coming along fine. And by the time I had been there 7 months, and by the way, how did I get the Distinguished Service Cross? Well, we had a big operation, as I said. We were making 2 and 3, and sometimes 4 landings a month across the beach. We had good intelligence, and what we were doing, we were destroying the enemy supplies, because they have to move the supplies in ahead of an attack, because they can't pack the stuff in. So we had our recon people picking it out. But anyway, we were really doing all right. And there was a big operation coming off. It had already gone on the paper when I got there, called Bold Mariner. And it was going to include a regiment from the Republic of Korea. The Republic of Korea Marines were on our left flank. And a regiment from the 1st Marine Division, a part of the 3rd Marine Division also. And it was going to be a big one. And it turned out we just got tons of food and stuff and destroyed and killed a lot of the enemy. And it turned out so well that we got a message to General Kearney that he was going to be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. And he fired the one back and said, I was in the hospital. Colonel Steve Wilson was in charge. So that's how I got the Distinguished Service Cross. So we were, there was only two medals higher than that in their system. So finally, I'm leaving out anything. Oh, by the time, after I'd been there about 7 months, our objectives had been accomplished. So we were pulling out. The 1st Marine Division had come home, and some of the maintenance people, the CBs, were beginning to come home, the construction battalion, and they disbanded the 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, so it freed up that whole bunch. So all of us that had been amphibious went ashore and were assigned to the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing or the 1st Marine Division at Da Nang and back up in the hills. And so I relieved the Brigadier General, General Spanninger. My job was Deputy Chief of Staff for direct air support for all of I Corps. I had a command center, and I was in charge of coordinating 4,000 airplanes, helicopters, and jets, and all that sort of thing, with 80,000 troops. Had a beautiful command center about 25 miles back in the mountains. I was safer there than I was in Washington, D.C., back in the mountains. And had a big control center with a 8-foot-tall piece of plexiglass and 15 feet wide and a guy writing on the back. Anything you want to know is all going on. And we had to make sure that when the artillery, the battleship Missouri, was there and it was shooting and all that sort of thing, you had to make sure we didn't shoot our own people. We had to coordinate all of that with the helicopters and the jets and all the others. And it was really a challenging job. Many outstanding experiences of how prayer was answered saved a lot of lives. It pays to be filled with the Holy Spirit. If you just get, a lot of interesting experiences on that. By the way, well, we'll get to that. But finally, Lyndon Johnson lifted the restriction from bombing in Cambodia for 20 days. And they had this, they figured, we've had it. That stopped it. So they wanted to talk. Lee Dok To, who was the foreign minister of the communists, said one day, the question was, how was it that the Americans won all the battles and lost the war? That is a good question, because we did. We won every battle, but still lost the war. Well, here's how it happened. He said, and he was true, we won the war in Paris, France, and Washington, D.C. I wondered, what is he talking about? Well, here's what he was talking about. There was a group in Washington that just about 3 years ago finally got the papers released. And here's what happened. Alexander Haig, a traitor, member of the Council of Foreign Relations, chosen by the conspirators, promoted, he's the only guy that when he was eligible to be a brigadier colonel, he was already a 1-star brigadier general, and he's the first one in all history that went from 2-star to 4-star. He never was a 3-star. He just skipped it. They do that sort of thing. But and so he made arrangements for Lee Dok To and the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, who is the chairman of the New World Order, to meet over in Paris, France. And here's what they agreed to. It's in the records. Henry Kissinger said, just let us get out. Let us be out for 2 or 3 years so that it'll, and then you can have it. So we were out. The last combat troops were out in 1973. Last American friend. But in 1975 in the budget, 2 or 3 years later, now remember these names, Ted Kennedy, McGovern, Church, Bayh, Javits, Fulbright, and Case put a one-line addendum in the federal budget which said this: there will be no further expenditure of appropriated funds in Southeast Asia. Cut the money off the collapse. 2 years later, the communists had killed, murdered, liquidated, they call it, purged, 1 million at least Laotians, 2 million South Vietnamese and 3 million Cambodians. If you don't believe it, go see the movie, The Killing Fields. And they had to clean that one up because it was worse than that. You can fight communism and lose probably 10% of the combatants. Once you surrender, you'll lose millions and millions of people. And Persian. The Lord never has been able to make me forgive the 7 people I just named. I don't know that they knew what they were doing, but nonetheless, as Ogden Nash says, rape is a crime unless you rape the people or murder them 1 million at a time, and then it's just politics. God forgive them. But it hurts because I knew some of those people that were killed. And came back to the States and went right back to Washington, D.C., represented the Marine Corps in a Navy operation. Okay, next one. This is what Vietnam looked like in most of the area. Rice paddies, and that's in that small strip along the coast. Next one. This is a building because we were economically stable. All these buildings were all designed for a specific purpose in peacetime. Next one. This is Cameron Bay, a beautiful harbor that didn't exist. The Navy Construction Battalion, the CBs, and the Army Engineers cooperated to build this. A beautiful harbor. Next. And this is the Da Nang Airport. It's an international, meets all the requirements for international airfield. And we did that. There were 3 others, one down at Saigon, one in the middle of the country, and this one. Perfect. Here's a city over here for operations. Marine Corps, 1st Marine Aircraft Wing was over here. Next one. Now, this is an airplane that you probably never heard of, the AD-1. We called it the Greaseball. This airplane weighed 11,000 pounds, and it would carry 12,000 pounds of bombs and ordnance and all the other things. It carried more bombs than a B-17 and only had one life at risk, mainly like this one up here. Now, we left the Vietnamese with about 100 of these, just perfect for keeping the communists out. And, of course, they had helicopters, the CH-46s and the Hueys. They were taking care of themselves. They had existed for 2 years, just beating the living tar out of anybody that had come into them. And they weren't restricted for the rules of engagement. So we can go to the next one now. Now, those airplanes were all turned over to the communists when the fuel ran out. All of that was turned over to the communists, lock, stock, and barrel, and to clean it up. Right now, South Vietnam has a greater gross domestic product per person than China. They didn't have to go into debt to build this operation we're talking about. We built it for them. And boy, a lot of people came to know the Lord. There's so many things that... But anyway, they say there's no atheist in the foxholes, and I really believe that. And there were sure a lot of wonderful experiences. How did I meet the Lord? Well, in Japan, my life was a shamble, a red-hot jet jockey and all that sort of thing, living the jet jockey life. But my marriage was on the rocks, and I loved my wife and my 2 children, and that really tore me up. So one night, I'd been to an award ceremony. We'd smuggled myself and another major, 2 LST loads of weapons, and smuggled them into Indonesia to defeat the communists. Secret operation. And we'd have a... And so I know I was shoo-in to make lieutenant colonel. But I got back to my little 12x12 room. I was totally disgusted with the whole thing. And finally, I got out on my knees. And I said, Lord, the life has to be more to life than this. I know I've lived a miserable life. I'd become an Episcopalian, but that just made me more miserable. And an Episcopalian is a Catholic who can't speak Latin. But by the way, they did have a renewal, and I was a part of that, with Dennis Bennett and some of those people. And the next thing I knew, that people that had mistreated me, I was forgiving them. And I started weeping. I hadn't cried since my grandfather died. Because that wasn't manly to cry. And all of a sudden I was confessing my sins. And the strange thing was that the more I confessed, the better I felt. And I couldn't understand why I was crying about it. And finally, I'd started at about 10 o'clock, and I finally got up to run. And I noticed by the watch it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. I went to sleep, and boy, did I sleep. I slept and woke up the next morning in a whole new world. Now, it was raining outside, as it usually did down there near Hiroshima. We were only 15 miles from Hiroshima. But it was really sunshiny. And by the way, when I looked in the mirror to shave, I could actually look like a jerk in the eye. I hadn't been able to do that for a long time. I knew something had changed. Stepped out the door and run right headlong into old Boomer. He was always bitter. Old Bitter Bob. He had one of the jet squadrons aboard, and if anything went wrong, he blamed the base, and that was me, and I didn't like him, and he didn't like me, and I'd knocked him off his bar stool one night, and they threw us out of the club. But I looked at him, and I can't say I loved him, but I did like him. I said, "Bob, why don't you have breakfast with me?" And he looked at me like, "I don't know about that." But being the commanding officer, I had a reserve table, and of course you get better service when you're the boss. So we sat there and just chit-chatted, and he kept looking at me, and he kept looking at me, and I knew what he was thinking. Now, old Speed's being nice to me because he's got something down the road, and he's going to really get it to me. You know, don't get mad, get even. But it didn't. And I had seven chaplains. The Roman Catholic chaplain was an alcoholic. The Greek Orthodox was shacked up with a Japanese woman off the base. And I didn't bother them. And the Lutheran chaplain, he thought he was an infantry officer, and I had to call him in and tell him to knock it off. He was a chaplain. He wasn't a troop commander, harassing the troops. So I finally went to the Baptist. Captain Burke. Billy Burke. I told him what had happened to me. He started smiling. He said, "Skipper, you've been born again. You are now a believer." And he explained it to me. He had the scripture. Well, I wanted another confirmation, so I went to a Presbyterian. And he looked at me and he says, "You got all the symptoms of being born again." And by the way, I stood in for him to get married at his wedding out there. So that was a whole new world. I'd like to tell you that everything went along great. But it did. People saw a difference. I saw a big difference. But then the 4th of July came along. So it was always time to have a big drunken brawl out at the beach. I had it at Imazu Beach. And so the commanding officer, of course, go out and give a speech. So I did and went out and told all the Marines how good they were and all that sort of thing. They all knew it, but, you know. And so I told them that I had come to know the Lord, and I looked forward to the day that I would look at a line of Marines and see nothing but born-again Christians. Hallelujah. Some of them sort of looked at me like, "That's weird." But a bunch of them came up, and they were excited because they were Christians, too. And I thought it was so great, I stayed around and got drunk with them. But walking back aboard the base, boy, I was miserable. I wasn't sick. I was just miserable. Woke up the next morning, I couldn't walk. My left knee was all swollen. So they sent me up to Tokyo to the Yokosuka Hospital. You can tell whether people have been to Japan or not, but they call Yokosuka Yokosuka, not Yokosuka. Sent me up there to the big hospital. The doctor said I had advanced arthritis in my left knee, and they couldn't treat it at Iwakuni. So the x-ray showed it and all that sort of thing. They started fiddling around with it, doing the therapy. And miserable. I was ambulatory. I could go out. So one night I thought I'd go to a movie. Went to a movie. Lousy movie. Came home. Went back into... back to my bunk. And I wanted to be alone. It was a Friday or Saturday night. And all these drunks were coming in. You know how cute you are when you're drunk. You look stupid to somebody that's sober, but boy, you think you're so funny. So I wanted to get away from them. And I remembered coming down the long corridor that there was a head, and there was an emergency room. And there were neat beds, about 200 beds, all for emergencies, standing by for emergencies. And so I was walking down the corridor. My boots, old combat boots, clanking on the cement, dragging on off the wall. And all of a sudden, I heard an audible voice. It didn't echo off the walls, but I sure heard it with these ears. It said, "Fear not, I'm with you." And I felt Jesus right at my left hand. I think I heard the rustle of his garments, but I was afraid to look because I figured if I looked, he'd go away, and it felt so good. He took about a half a dozen steps with me, and then he left. And I ran to my bunk, pulled off my boots, went down the hall to this emergency area, and there was a big sign that said, "Head," to you, that's toilet. If you're in the Army, it's a latrine, but the Marines and Navy, it's the head. And I flipped on the light, and there it was. There were 7 urinals on one wall and 7 commodes on the other. No booths. The true joke was, we had an open fellowship. Everybody just come in and sit down. So I got out on my knees right there between the urinals and the commodes, and I was angry at me for what I had done. And I said, "Lord God, give me the power to do the things I know I ought to do and to quit using this foul language. Give me the power to do what a Christian should do." And with that, I was knocked right on the floor. I thought, boy, this is strange. And it was pretty weird because I wasn't drunk. And all of a sudden, my tongue started flapping around and I was making funny sounds. And I had to bite my tongue to get it to quit. And I thought, now somebody will come in here and see me laying the floor, crying and my tongue flapping around. And they're going to say, you're coming up a little short on the marble count. They put you in that jacket where you hug yourself and they haul you off to the silly bin. But I thought, well, now if this is being crazy, it ain't half bad. But I felt better. And I really don't know how long I was there. But finally I got up and boy, did I feel, I felt sort of just wrung out. Just great. And I went back to my bunk and lay down and boy, did I sleep. Woke up the next morning, the doctor, a Navy commander, shaking me. I'd missed breakfast and always like to eat. And the doctor's standing there, he says, "Major Wilson, let's have a look at your knee." We went through every morning. He grabbed me by the knee, give it a big pump, watch my face to see if it hurt. And it didn't hurt. And he looked at me and he said, "What happened?" I said, "I did some praying last night." He frowned and went down to the foot of the bunk and picked up his clipboard, shook his head. He hadn't recommended prayer. I don't know what he was thinking. Finally he says, "Well, go get an x-ray." So I walked about a quarter mile and got an x-ray. About an hour later, he and another commander showed up with the x-ray and says, "Now, here was the x-ray 2 weeks ago, and here's the x-ray now. We don't know what the problem is, but you're free for duty." So I called an airplane back down to Yukoni and resumed my command from my executive officer. So that's how I met the Lord and was baptized in the Holy Spirit. Really didn't know what had happened to me until I got involved with the Full Gospel Businessmen, and they were telling me all about it, and then met Derek Prince. Derek Prince and I got to know each other real well. If you ever knew him, well, we called him Prince Derek because he's so stoic and aloof, you know, the British bit. And he had heard my testimony and I'd heard his. He knew that there was a Lord, and he was in South Africa, and he was in a horse stable, and his roommate wasn't a horse, it was another soldier. And he sat down on a log in the horse stable and looking out at the sky through a small window, and he says, "God, I'm not moving until you manifest your presence to me." And he said with that, he was knocked right off on the floor, off of that into the hay and the straw and the horse manure and whatnot, and started speaking in tongues, and he couldn't stop and whatnot. And he was afraid when his friend, the soldier, came that he wouldn't be able to speak English. And that was his experience, and he historically said, "The Lord's prejudice, he gave you a clean floor, and he gave me the old floor." Oh, great. So that's my story at headquarters, Marine Corps, that type of thing. And the next one, we'll call it quits. Retired in 1973, the first day of July, retired. And the next one, what I do now is on Memorial Day. This was the University of Akron. Memorial Day, I'm asked to come and represent the Marine Corps and dedicating to the warriors. And I guess the biggest, and also quite often, I think it's been 7 times that I've been what I call a grand marshal of the Veterans Day parade, where you set up on the back of a sports car and everybody looks at it. That feels so stupid. But it feeds the ego considerably. There was a real interesting one down in Tampa, Florida. They decided in their annual Memorial Day they were going to have a veteran from World War II, and a veteran from Korea, and a veteran from Vietnam. We're going to have 3. And there was a fellow there that had heard me speak, and he said, "I can get you all 3 of them in one. Get 3 for 1. So I was invited down to Tampa. Big outfit, over a million people down. It was a lot of fun. It was interesting, the land parade and then the parade of boats on one Saturday and the next Saturday the other. So that's, and I'm being asked more and more to speak to the Tea Party groups. And that's the Tea Party groups, because there's not a dime's difference between Democrats and Republicans, if you haven't finished that out. And say, well, the Tea Party's going to split it, and the Democrats will get back in. It doesn't make any difference. The same people run the government regardless of who's in. And we'll be talking about that Saturday night, understanding world events. And then the next one, and I think that's it. Yeah, that's it. Start over. So, God bless you for your patience to listen to a blabbering old man.
This is the end of this message. Our website is www.LakeHamiltonBibleCamp.com and LHBCOnline.com. There are many free audio files there. It's like going to Bible school at home. Thank you.